Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey everyone, it is Martinis and Murder. Did you like that, John?
Boy. I love when you start the show with a good little jingle. I feel like it just really like puts me in a good mood.
Well, as you know from Another Shot, I'm out in the Hamptons, so I'm feeling a little bit chipper than be stuck in my shitty little apartment in New York City. So all is good and life is happening. The real question, though, John, is are you drinking this week? Because we weren't drinking last week. Are we going to continue that trend?
Yeah, I'm technically drinking. I guess I'll just be honest. I'm just having a Starbucks like Frappuccino chilled drink that you would get at a convenience store because I don't know where you are. I know you're in Hamptons, Darren. I don't know what the weather is there, but it has been so rainy here and it's just made me so lethargic. Yeah. And I had so much to do today work-wise, so I had to, like, pump my blood full of caffeine today. So that's what I'm drinking at the moment.
You could put a little pour of Bailey's in there.
I was just thinking that. Yeah. I was just thinking that, and I unfortunately don't have any here, which is very weird for me. I do have my brown sugar bourbon, though, but I don't think it's going to mix well with
I don't think that'll mix well. I'm actually drinking. I've upgraded it. So I'm only having one shot of vodka in my drink this week because I have to do a company-wide event after this. So I cannot be drunk. Not everyone is as professional as Martinis and Murder what they're drinking.
Right.
But I am having one shot of vodka and then I am drinking a bubbly, which is like a flavored seltzer. It's a lemon flavored seltzer. So I've really increased my game, not necessarily increasing my budget, but I'm very proud of myself today. And I think Matt is here, and I got to know if Matt's drinking, like, apple juice, milk, and rum. Matt, are you drinking anything right now, and are you feeding anything to your children?
And is it Pedialyte?
Correct.
I have a real cocktail this week, and it's a martini. It's a gin martini straight up. Well, it's not straight up. I have a little bit of vermouth in it, and that's it. Okay. And because the last couple weeks, I don't think I drank the last couple weeks, actually. But, you know, I need a drink today, so.
Well, let me put this caveat out right now, Matt, is that you might not have been drinking for the past couple weeks on the show, but I highly doubt you weren't drinking the other 6 days of the week. That's just my bet. I feel like now more than ever, reindeers are getting drunk. That's 2020. That's 2020, folks.
You would be correct.
I figured that. Well, obviously, this week's episode is a continuation of our last week, where we're talking about the Watts and Birmingham riots. And, you know, Matt, I actually wanted to toss to you right up at the top because we were sort of having this interesting conversation when we started, and I wanted you to kind of explain to the audience because you had just done such phenomenal research on this. And thanks to you and John for both putting in the hard work. But just the language that we're going to be using, and I was hoping that you could kind of explain to the audience maybe why we started using uprising as opposed to riots.
Yeah, so it had to do within the first part one of this two-parter when we talked to someone who had been in the Watts riot, technically the name is the Watts riot, and that's how publications refer to it, and that's pretty much how everyone refers to it. And I don't think, on the one hand, I went back and forth, is this kind of splitting cares? It's like a riot is basically like civil disorder, you know, and that's what is happening. But at the same time, you know, he did make a really good point that, like, you know, in his opinion, I think he said a riot is like a drunken brawl at USC when a football game is lost, you know, like, and in his opinion, there's a point to all of these. And we started calling them uprisings. Because people, you know, they might be mad and they might just kind of go ballistic for a couple of days, but there's a reason that they're doing it. And so I just kept the terminology to uprising for this part two of this.
Well, thank you for that background. I mean, John, I don't know if you disagree with this at all, but to me, it sort of feels like riot, for better or for worse, kind of has this connotation of maybe this negative, this pejorative kind of undertone. Whereas uprising to me says something that like a movement is really happening, you know, and this was a moment in time that we need to focus on. So I feel really comfortable saying uprising because this is such a monumental time in history. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. And I think, you know, you both have put it perfectly. And I think you and I, Darren, talked a little bit about that specifically in part one last week. But yeah, I totally agree. I mean, especially nowadays where media, you know, is so much more vast in terms of like the different avenues you can read something or interpret information. And it's so, I feel like words like riots can get misconstrued quickly.
Yeah.
And to the public, in my opinion. So I completely agree. And I think, you know, I think Matt, you had a really good idea with this. And I think I'm glad we're letting people know at the top. Did you have anything more you wanted to add about it?
Yeah, just very quickly that, you know, we talk about like vastly different circumstances and events in this part two of this. And, you know, some of these uprisings, we will use that term, you know, you could see why people would more refer to them as riots, because they're, you know, it's like looting, burning down neighborhoods, etc. I think uprisings still make sense because there's still a reason that people are doing it. But and then on some other occasions, it's, you know, they're more organized marches, and they were peaceful. You know, it doesn't mean that the police treated them peacefully, but they were peaceful marches that were, you know, often led by civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. And they were just, the strategies were, you know, really well thought out. And they called the press and they, you know, they tried to think of every detail and how to keep people safe, but how to be heard. So there are two, you know, we're using the term uprising, but there's just like, you know, on the occasions where like, you know, things happen because the police pull someone over in a car or something, and then the crowd gets out of control. You know, those, you know, as we heard in the first part one, I think those are just more, it's just like raw emotion that's just set on fire, basically. So I just wanted to make that distinction.
That's a really great way to put that. And especially nowadays, and Darren, let me know what you think, and to piggyback off of what Matt was saying is, especially nowadays with the Black Lives Matter movement, and especially the last month, there's such a weird conflation to me between rioting and protesting with people that don't really understand that there's a major, major difference between the two of those things. And I would say there's even a third kind of subcategory of just people that are looting, which is completely separate from, you know, because like what Matt was just explaining, rioting can be in a purpose of protest. You know, people will do, you know, people threw, you know, bricks at Stonewall. And, you know, we all know, we'll talk more about that in a future episode. You know, that was rioting for a purpose, not necessarily looting, which we've seen a lot in the news lately of people just smashing through Targets and stealing toilet paper.
Yeah, and I don't think that is an uprising in any sort of way. That gives me more of a riot connotation. But yes, we sort of briefly mentioned this in the last week's episode that what we certainly don't want is for the looters, if we could say, to take away from the message that the protesters who are really peaceful, especially right now, we don't want that to take away from the message. So when we're sort of talking about protesters, it's the one that are actually moving the needle with this stuff, not the people who were looting it. But with that said, I think we should get into part two and our continuation of the Watson-Birmingham uprising, if you will.
Yeah, so last week we ended with John F. Kennedy's beautiful speech announcing civil rights legislation on June 11th, 1963. And I'll tell you, Darren, like, after we recorded that episode, it really stuck with me, a lot of what John F. Kennedy was saying. I kept thinking about the information we had about Martin Luther King Jr. and, you know, my realization about how eloquent and just peace driven he really was. And this week we're going to begin with an even more famous speech, with his I Have a Dream speech, which of course most of us, if you grew up in the United States and you're in my generation, mine and Darren's, you're familiar with this in some capacity, hopefully.
Yes.
It's arguably the greatest speech ever delivered in the history of the United States. We won't read it since we can't really do it justice, but it was given on August 28th, 1963 at the March on Washington. The speech was carried live by television stations across the country, and more than 260,000 people had gathered for it. I mean, we've all seen those photos of, you know, the National Mall and the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument just packed to the brim. Full of people. I was really lucky enough to be able to participate in Barack Obama's first inauguration in 2008. And we were down there on that mall. And I just kept thinking the entire time, I was actually kind of right in front of the Washington Monument. I mean, it was history, you know, the first black president. Who would have ever thought we would, you know, this country would get to that point? And I just felt a complete, like, instinct to participate in that history. And when we were down there, all I could think of was like, oh, like, this is exactly the same kind of imagery, and I'm participating in some kind of big movement. And those types of images that I saw in our history books, you know, from this moment when Martin Luther King Jr. gave his speech. So I thought it was a really cool experience.
And I agree with that. And I think, you know, especially with this speech, I mean, among others, you know, we have tons of famous speeches in history, but, you know, the phrase, like, a picture is worth a thousand words. And I think a lot of those pictures, to the National Mall, to the protests, really stay true to that statement.
Yeah, totally. But, you know, even though that many people had gathered, the violence didn't stop. It was an amazing movement, but of course, violence continued. On September 15th, 1963, white supremacists bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, where four young black girls were killed in the explosion. Sarah J. Rudolph lost her little sister and her right eye in the blast. Recounting the bombing to the Library of Congress, she said she heard a loud noise and called out to her sister three or four times, but got no response. The girls were in rubble in the church's bathroom, which is just something you feel like you would hear in another country, but it's right here in our own. Someone carried her out of the church and took her to a hospital. Sarah said, quote, "The doctor told me after they operated on my face that I had about 22 shards of glass in my face.
Oh my God.
When it was all over with, they took the patches off my eye and I had lost my right eye and I could barely see out of my left eye. I stayed in the hospital about 2.5 months," end quote. And Darren, I know you in particular do not like, you know, this type of injury.
Well, I was going to say, this is particularly triggery for me. My cousin lost his eye in a car accident, and that, like, that absolutely demolished me. And then hearing about this, my biggest fear for, you know, any of the listeners who don't know, is to go blind. And so anything with my eye, I just absolutely freak out about. But this, I mean, what just like a horrible thing
lose
to
it
have
in,
happened
in
for
this
an
manner.
Explosion. Right, exactly, is not something anyone would want, for sure. But specifically me, because of my fear, yes. And Matt, I think you have something to add with this, right?
Yeah, just this, I have the same thing. This really struck me because my mom lost an eye. Mm-hmm. And I think I've said that before the show. So she lost an eye, and then she has an extremely rare condition where the healthy eye copied the dead eye, and over the course of about 7 years, she went completely blind, and she's 100% blind now.
Oh my God, that's terrible.
Wow, I didn't even know that an eye could sort of copy another eye. That just might be my ignorance, but wow. I mean,
wow.
You know, I'm sure she's lucky to have a reindeer son like you.
That's
Matt.
True.
Yeah, it is so rare. Sorry, this is a crazy tangent, but this will be brief. It is so rare that it only happens in 1 of 10,000 people who lose an eye.
Wow.
Really?
So
it only happens in 1 in 10,000 people who lose an eye? That is, the odds of that seem absolutely absurd.
Yes, she's been asked to attend conferences of ophthalmologists who just want, like, she'll sit in a room and they just want to come up and talk to her because they've never seen anyone who has this condition.
Wow, that's terrible.
I got to talk to your mom to make make me feel a little bit better about this because it is freaking me out, I got to say.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, anyway, back to the case.
Well, yes. Now. Okay, so back to what was happening in 63. So 2 months later, on November the 22nd, 1963, John F. Kennedy was shot in the head by a sniper. We all know that tragic story.
We've even covered the case
on this show.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so these uprisings, as we're calling them, were a constant happening throughout the rest of 1964. But as the National Geographic noted, the uprisings in the 60s were different from race riots in the earlier part of the 1900s, which were started by angry mobs of white people, as they often are, by the way. Here's a quote, quote, "The first wave came in the early 20th century, culminating in the so-called Red Summer of 1919, when the country was recovering from World War I, bitterly divided by racial and gender tensions and anti-immigration fervor and ravaged by the deadly Spanish flu epidemic," end quote. Darren, I can't help but notice the similarities between 1919, I almost said 1990.
No, say it right now, John. 1990.
And 2020, I mean, that's kind of actually a little bit bizarre if you think about it.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, certainly 2020 is almost this unprecedented year, and I think people are very much so relating it to 1918, 1919. But at the same time, there's a slew of stuff going on right now.
Well,
but absolutely, we're sort of mirroring it as close as we kind of can.
Yeah, history is repeating itself in a certain sense. Well, National Geographic also reported, I almost said geographic, guys, quote, "In 1921, white mobs, with the complicity of local police, torched Tulsa, Oklahoma's black business district known as Black Wall Street, killing about 300 people and leaving nearly all of the city's black population homeless. In most of these massacres and riots, the police turned a blind eye to white violence and instead arrested African Americans for defending themselves," end quote.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
That seems great. That seems awesome. You know what? A lot of that is being mirrored today as well, I gotta say. Yes.
Yeah, but let's go back to 1964. And as we mentioned in the first episode, from 1964 to 1971, there were more than 750 riots, killing 228 people and injuring nearly 13,000 others.
Wow. I mean, that's a huge... I mean, there's first off, 750 uprisings is a massive number, but let alone killing that many people is just tragic.
Well, and actually, at a time, sorry not to interrupt you, but also in a time where it's not super... or not as easy as it is now to sort of, you know, organize and congregate. I mean, we have social
right,
media.
No social media.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is just true power of the people. I actually wanted to go through some of the marches, uprisings, and significant events that took place in 1964.
Yeah.
So on June 9th, 1964, there was a peaceful march led by Reverend T.Y. Rogers Jr. against segregated restrooms and drinking fountains with the quote, whites only signs in the Tuscaloosa, Alabama courthouse. Obviously, we've seen these photos several times, mm-hmm. separating whites and blacks for sure. This day specifically has become known as Bloody Tuesday. Mm-hmm. The marchers were planning to walk from the First African Baptist Church to the courthouse, but were immediately tear gassed and beaten. Mm-hmm. Again, very mirror from 2020. Mm-hmm. There was no media or journalist there to cover the march, but 33 men, women, and children were hospitalized, and 94 people were arrested, according to TuscaloosaNews.com. But there was a bright spot on July 2nd, 1964, about a month before the Watts riot, when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination of all kinds based on race, color, religion, or national origin. It was the legislation that had been worked on by Kennedy. Now, I know we just talked about it in another shot, but let's re-mention it again, how great the Supreme Court was for finally allowing gays and transgender, all walks of gender and all walks of sex and sexuality to finally not be discriminated against, according to the government. Some good news out of 2020.
Yes, specifically about being fired from their jobs. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Amazing.
But they said nothing about reindeers, so I still feel confident that we can fire Matt and it be okay. Am I right about this?
I think so. I think it's really like the ticks. You know, it's a bad tick season. Yeah. We can't be, you know, it's a public health thing with him.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Take a drink, John.
Yeah, thank you. I will, actually, yes.
Well, as The Atlantic notes, even after the Civil Rights Act was signed into law, quote, segregation remained the norm in many establishments, which we've seen, right? Because sometimes it's hard to tell what's federal, what's run by states, and several states, specifically in the South, really fought back at this. And The Atlantic reported, quote, small town all-white schools were required to integrate, and big city schools began large-scale efforts to integrate by bus. So segregationists, angered by this Civil Rights Act, took to the streets as well, often attacking African-American demonstrations across the South. So a couple weeks after, on July 16th, 1964, right here in Harlem, New York, a white off-duty police officer shot and killed a 15-year-old black student, according to NPR, much similar to today.
Yeah.
After 2 days of peaceful protests, a crowd assembled at the police precinct calling for the arrest of the officer. They were met by the NYPD swinging clubs, which is not something you ever want to meet the end of. And an uprising broke out and lasted for 6 full days. It actually spread from Harlem to Bed-Stuy and Brownsville in Brooklyn and to South Jamaica in Queens. So kind of rampant around the city, it sort of feels like. These are big uprisings now. A New York assemblywoman who grew up in Harlem told NPR, quote, it was an emotionalism that causes you to riot in your own community and not downtown, where economics will really impact upon the decision-making of those in power. But they would probably have shot us if the riot occurred downtown. Which is which is an interesting point, because a lot of time it is really set and setting, and it is location of where you're choosing
for sure
to do it. And certainly for people of color, you kind of have to choose your best option here when you're rioting, and you know, you want to be heard. So wherever location you're going to be heard the loudest, that's where the people wanted to go.
Yeah.
One person died, 100 were injured, and 450 people were arrested. A woman who was 4 years old in 1964 remembers her mom taking part in a march at the police precinct in Harlem. For a separate instance, she told AARP that her uncle, a salesman, saw the police beating up a young boy for allegedly stealing fruit.
Oh,
quote,
God.
My uncle asked the police, what did the young boy do? And the police beat my uncle so bad that his eyeball was smashed.
Oh,
then
God.
They left him in the precinct for hours before he was sent to a hospital. The doctors were unable to save his eye, so he spent the rest of his days wearing a patch, end quote, she said. And that's according to AARP. But I got to say, another eye incident, but just horrible, just horrible in every single way for doing this, especially for just stealing fruit.
Yeah, so on July, so, by the way, I just want to mention, it's like, you know, our generation now, the people that are in their 30s with some kids these days, you know, there's so much talk about how, like, you know, this stuff wasn't happening or this is all new. And I'm like, this was happening in the 60s. I mean, imagine the generations of racism and generational suffering that people of color have dealt with. And there are still people to this day who think that it's all made up or that, you know, it's not as serious as the protesters are making it out. I mean, this is only the 60s, which is still like 50 some years, you know, 60 years ago. But, you know, it's so prevalent.
But geologically, that actually isn't that long
exactly.
of a time. You know what I mean? So, I mean, progress has been made, but it also kind of hasn't. And
right.
it's been...
In some ways,
right? I mean, actually, you know, I don't want to, there's no better time to probably living here. You know, I'm a very cautious optimist, you know what I mean? So obviously, like, there's never been a time to be better time to be gay, be a woman. But sure, it just goes to show like how 50 years sometimes seems like a lifetime and can also seem like literally a moment in time.
Exactly. So on July 24th, 1964, someone asked two police officers for help with an intoxicated young black man at a street dance party in Rochester, New York. The white officers arrested him, but the crowd surrounded them to prevent the officers from taking the man. The policeman called for backup and more officers came, plus a canine unit. The Rochester City newspaper wrote, quote, the dogs may have been the match tossed into the dry tinder of years of frustration and anger, end quote. So sort of saying here, wow, the history is a fire was lit, if you will. Yes. 1,500 National Guard troops were sent in. Property damage topped $1 million and 350 people were injured. So this is, you know, the 60s. I mean, it's month after month of all of this very kind of extreme happenings. And like Darren and I keep saying, it's very mirrored to what's going on now. So only about a month later, August 16th, 1964, an uprising broke out after a struggle between a 22-year-old black woman and a Chicago liquor store owner who was a 6-foot-tall, 265-pound man known as Big Mike. The woman was allegedly trying to steal a pint of gin, and this became known as the gin bottle riot, which I had heard of and didn't realize that's exactly what where it started.
Yeah.
Yeah, the police arrested the shoplifter and Big Mike because a crowd said the 22-year-old woman had been roughed up. The woman also denied trying to steal, and being upset over the treatment of the woman, a crowd gathered and soon looted the liquor store and set it on fire with a Molotov cocktail, according to the Chicago Tribune. So
now that's a powerful statement. First, like a Molotov cocktail is no fucking joke, but
no,
you know, and even though it's hard to say because we weren't there, but it's certainly easy for just a crowd mentality. You know, I've sort of been part of this before, in that when I say like, I wasn't terrorist, but it was associated to it because it was at JFK Airport when I was going to Paris a few years ago, if you remember. And it was during the Olympics. And there was sort of a, you know, someone was screaming. I think it was for Usain Bolt, like during track. And because there was so like, you don't know what was going on, just a crowd of people thought that a gunman was in the airport and people just start running. You know what I mean? So it's really easy for someone to be like, I didn't steal. I thought I did. For someone to sort of break out in a crowd gathering and looting and setting on fire, there is a short amount of time that it can go from kind of, you know, normal run of the mill day to a huge uprising is all I'm saying. It's not that hard to do it. You know what I mean? With a crowd mentality.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that, and then I was also thinking about this one time someone dropped their luggage, and, like, the handle smashed against the floor, and it sounded like a gunshot, and everyone started screaming and running.
Yep.
I mean, it really doesn't take that much to sort of, you know, signal to a crowd of people that something's going wrong. Police moved in on this crowd of 1,000 people with dogs, axe handles, shotguns, and tear gas, according to the New York Times.
Jesus, armed and ready, I guess. For
exactly.
We don't know,
Yeah, the woman was convicted of shoplifting and Big Mike was acquitted, according to the Tribune. Then on August 28th, 1964, the car of a black woman stalled in North Philadelphia. She got into an argument with two police officers, one white, one black, about her inability to move the car, and a crowd began to form. The officers then physically removed her from the car and a man attacked the officers in an attempt to help her. They were both arrested, and rumors spread throughout North Philadelphia that a pregnant black woman had been beaten to death by white police officers. Yeah, racial tensions had already been building for months due to several well-publicized accusations of police brutality, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Angry mobs began to loot and burn businesses in the neighborhood. The police felt outnumbered, so they just left, and the looting and arsons continued for 2 days before everything kind of simmered down. Northern Philly was left smoldering.
I think it's important to say, after talking about that, and Matt, I want to get your take on this in just a second, but, you know, like I said, like, no matter if it's the 60s with social media or 2020, whatever we have going on, these behaviors are starting to mirror themselves. And it's really easy for something to kind of break out. But we don't want the looting and the arson to sort of take away from the overall message. Matt, what's your kind of take on this?
I just wanted to comment that I, you know, I lived in North Philly for a little while. And it was by far the roughest neighborhood that I've ever lived in. And it's just, I mean, I just feel like, you know, obviously it wasn't doing well before this riot happened, but I just feel like I'm just not sure that it ever really recovered, you know. And then Philadelphia had a mayor that, you know, ran on being hard, basically, on the rioters, kind of like President Trump, you know. It's like, well, we'll just shoot them, you know. And he won based on this riot. And it's just like the neighborhood, it's just so hard to like communicate how incredibly like there's just the struggles of the people in this neighborhood. Like they just have nothing. And it's just there's still burned out buildings, rubble. You know, it's like a 10-minute walk to a nice part of town, but like there's literally falling down buildings, burned out buildings. It's just crazy.
Well, and to your point, I mean, sometimes things just can't recover from it, you know, and you kind of see these wounds, these scars, these open, you know, these open sort of sores from a time in history that we really haven't gotten over and we really haven't rectified yet.
Yeah. And also to Matt's point, it's like it's usually the oppressed, the disadvantaged, these types of minority type of groups that are, you know, most vocal and wanting the most equality. And that's just a natural instinction, I think, for human beings in a society that we live in. So it's somewhat expected that that would be, you know, the types of organizations that get together for that type of thing, in my opinion, at least.
Absolutely.
Well, only a month or two later, on October 14th, 1964, Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Peace Prize for his nonviolent resistance to racial prejudice, which, of course, I find very inspiring. I really love that about him. It had been nearly a decade since he had risen to prominence as a civil rights leader by organizing the successful Montgomery bus boycott. At 35 years old, he was the youngest to have ever won the Nobel Peace Prize. And Darren, I'm 34, so the idea that I would ever win a Nobel Peace Prize shows you how vastly different Martin Luther King Jr. and I
are. You still have a chance, though, John, to be the youngest to have ever won. I'm just saying, think of this as an opportunity for growth.
Totally.
Don't compare yourself, you know?
Yeah, well, even since I was a young boy, young man, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. has always been inspirational to me. He was unfortunately assassinated only 4 years after this on April 4th, 1968, as we all know. There were a lot of comparisons to Martin Luther King Jr. With the, I guess you could say, the antagonists of the recent riots and protests that were happening. And I kept seeing a lot of memes that were like, yeah, and look what happened. Everybody, you know, he was assassinated.
Right. So
it's like, even when you win the Nobel Peace Prize for your peaceful approach to this, his life was ended by gun violence. So,
well, anyone that has a strong opinion about something, whether it's good or bad, you know, look at JFK, look at MLK. I mean, it just, it's sad when you put yourself out there to try and change the world that these tragic things can happen. The only good thing I can say about it, which obviously is nothing good outside of his message, that was really left a legacy of just hope and peace and something that we're able to come back to. So that's slight good news in something horrible. He's a martyr for the cause for a just cause. Well, the striking thing about many of these uprisings is often, you know, that they feel familiar, what we were talking about at Arthur, about more than just a single incident. You know, their underlying cause is often vast disparities in quality of education, lack of affordable housing, arrest rates, incarceration and sentencing, police abuse, other factors of the systemic racism. And that's really what the Black Lives Matter movement is all about. And obviously, you know, I've been a huge supporter of the Innocence Project for a while now. And this disparity, I think the Innocence Project is just one of many organizations is trying to help that and help the people who are really being affected negatively by all of this with the systemic racism. And in many of these examples, something just, you know, petty or insignificant, stealing a bottle of gin can really just set these things off. A traffic stop was in the case of the Watts riot, a young woman allegedly stealing a bottle of gin in Chicago, like I mentioned, a woman whose car broke down in Philly. You know, recently with Rashad Brooks, it was him falling asleep in a Wendy's, and a intoxicated man at a street party in Rochester. Whatever the case, these examples often feel very familiar to recent cases. And, you know, let's take Eric Garner, right, who police suspected of selling single cigarettes, Lucy's as they're called, on Staten Island. There was Freddie Gray being arrested in Baltimore for possession of a switchblade, 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a BB gun in a Cleveland park, Breonna Taylor, who was actually sleeping in her bed in Louisville when officers shot and killed her after entering with a no-knock warrant, And they were in the wrong address, by the way. A lawsuit filed by the family actually alleges the warrant was for a man who didn't live in Taylor's apartment complex. And not only that, he was already in custody. I mean, I could go on and on in the last, but not least. I mean, certainly probably won't be the last. Certainly he's not the least. George Floyd allegedly trying to pass a counterfeit $20 bill in Minneapolis, which he may or may not have known to be counterfeit. So, it keeps going. You know what I mean? And just recently, Rashad Brooks, as I said, falling asleep in his car at the Wendy's parking lot.
So Trayvon Martin, who was walking
Skittles, you know what I mean, with a hoodie.
Arbery, who was jogging. I mean, like, it's obvious that this shit is like not just police doing their, you know, their best work. Let's put it that way.
Well, on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, which I'm a huge fan of. If you guys don't know it, you know, HBO, he's sort of Daily Show alum. He actually had a really thought-provoking episode titled Police. And he read the following 2019 quote from Khalil Gibran Muhammad, a Harvard professor. And it says, quote, "I read the report of the 1919 riot in Chicago, and it is as if I were reading the report of the investigating committee of the Harlem riot of 1935, mm-hmm. the report of the investigating committee of the Harlem riot of 1943, the report of the McCone Commission on the Watts riot. I must again in candor say to you, it is kind of Alice in Wonderland with the same moving picture re-shown over and over again, the same analysis, the same recommendations, mm-hmm. and the same inaction," end quote. And the statement is actually interesting in light of a recent New York Times article about Republicans struggling to respond for widespread demands for police overhaul. Mm-hmm. In the article, a Republican pollster and messaging expert said, quote, "In every survey, you see intensity, determination, and unity among African Americans, that the time for statements is done and the time for meaningful, measurable action is now. The turning point is among white respondents who not only acknowledge that injustice has happened, but now also agree that action, not words, are necessary." Mm. And the Times cited a new poll conducted by the Washington Post saying, quote, "Nearly 70% of Americans viewed the killing of George Floyd, the black man whose death last month after an encounter with Minneapolis police officers, as indicative of a broader problem with law enforcement rather than an isolated episode," end quote. And I just want to say on top of all this, because I've actually been kind of a known critic of police just in general. I mean, I think that was one of the reasons, and just law enforcement in general, we talk about a criminal justice system and how it's really rigged and how, you know, it depends mm-hmm. on the color of your skin or how you grew up or how much money you have that you can kind of get away with murder, it feels like. And for me, that's why I've been a proponent of the Innocence Project. But it's sort of important to note that, you know, saying these things, you know, Black Lives Matter, it's so important, but it's also important for the overall message of what we can do. And I don't think necessarily saying defund the police to me is like too vague of a thing to say, right? Because it could mean 1,000 different things to 1,000 different people. So mm-hmm. I think now more than ever, because these conversations are happening, people are starting to understand what qualified immunity is. People are starting to understand that police have unions and now they're taking action for it. And I couldn't be prouder of the people that are actually having these conversations and these debates in the important way, as opposed to just saying statements that might not go anywhere.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree with you. And I also do feel, though, that, like, yes, statements in and of themselves, you know, are not actionable, except it may inspire somebody, or it may, you know, have someone think, oh, what does defund the police mean? Let me go and research exactly what that means. Because yes, to your point, defund the police isn't exactly what it sounds like, you know, I think to a common lay person, so to speak. So, you know, statements like even the, I know, Darren, you were somewhat critical, I think, last week of the like black image that was sweeping Instagram last week. But I do wonder if that inspired or maybe brought attention to someone scrolling through Instagram that may not, you know, have thought about what was happening otherwise, which unfortunately there are people that even amongst maybe one of the biggest civil rights movements in history still are going to Instagram to, you know, see what's up on their favorite like meal prep account. You know what I'm talking about? So
absolutely.
Some of that's kind of like blackout on Instagram. I thought it was.
Oh yeah. I just mean like it's, now it's taken to the next level. You know what
exactly,
I mean? Because people are like,
yeah.
Oh, I see all these blackout squares. Great. What does it mean? How can we help people? And I think that that has been so important for this movement now more than ever.
I completely agree. Yeah. So we'll keep going here. Larry Aubrey, an eyewitness to what happened in Watts, who we mentioned in part one of our coverage because he told the LA Daily News about how he'd witnessed police shooting at looters coming out of a store, also gave an interview to the Los Angeles Times about not giving in to discouragement. Larry was born in New Orleans and as a kid moved to LA, which, as the Times noted, had its own forms of segregation. There were swimming pools he couldn't use and restaurants he couldn't go to. And when his mother transferred him from an all-black high school to a nearly all-white one, he was met with signs out front that said, quote, no N-words. And tar Barbies were hanging in effigy, according to the
FAQ. I can't.
I know, just terrible imagery.
But you know, it's important to say it because people need to know how disgusting that imagery is. Because the more, the best disinfectant is sunlight. And the more that people are aware of these images and are saying them as hard as they are to say, even with some of the murders we cover here, it's important for one small step to your point, even about having a black box to preventing history from repeating itself in any sort of negative way.
Absolutely. And Darren, just to be clear, the best disinfectant is sunlight, but we should make a statement here. Not in your blood, though, right? We don't want people putting sunlight.
Please do
in
not
your
drink
blood.
Bleach. Don't yeah, none of that. Bleach. No. I mean metaphorically, Tom.
Metaphorically.
Intellectually, if you will.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm glad we could make a stand.
Yeah.
On that particular thing. Well, Larry, who has been writing columns for the Los Angeles Sentinel for years, told the LA Times, quote, some things are better and has to do with opportunities that opened up socially, economically, and politically, and there's no question about that. And Darren, I think that's what you were just saying as well.
Exactly.
Quote, but it's been confined to a relatively small group in the black community, end quote. He believes what is needed is a, quote, sustained righteous outrage, end quote, that hasn't existed since the 1960s. Well, we might be there.
Maybe we're getting it, yeah.
Yeah, quote, it's not a riot he wants, but a social rebellion, wrote a columnist for the LA Times. Could that be what's happening now? I think it might be. The New York Times had an article checking in with civil rights activists who marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. about what's going on today. That's fascinating. I'm going to be reading all of that. But some excerpts here. Rutha Mae Harris, who is 79 years old and once marched and was jailed with King, said she's been watching the news constantly, sometimes with tears coming down her face. She said that in particular, the sight of kneeling police officers and throngs of white protesters surprised her and gave her hope. She says, quote, I thought what I had done was in vain. Oh, that's
wow.
So
what a powerful statement to be, you know, on the precipice of being 80 years old, you know, this octogenarian who has lived with this her entire life to sort of see this come to fruition 50 years later, praying it's coming to fruition now. We're sort of in the midst of it. It's hard to see exactly what's going to happen, but I'm hoping something for the better has got to at least feel, you know, to her point, like she fought for the cause all of her life and now she's kind of reaping the benefits of it, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. She also said, quote, what we had, it was not equivalent. When you see the cops kneeling, I just love that. And there are a lot of young white people. I've never seen that. We had some white people, but not as many, end quote. That is a good point. There are a lot of young white people nowadays that you don't really see in the history books. You know what I mean? You don't see young teenagers out the way I feel like we do these days.
Well, I think that's a testament to the movement. And I also think it's a testament to progress. And I think that shouldn't be, you know, understated. Like the world is getting better slowly but surely. And as we see more white people, just more people in general, supporting this obviously moral cause and just cause, it's really important. Matt, you know, as someone who's, you know, going on his 100th year of life, have you seen anything different?
Oh my God.
Oh my God. That's right. No, I just wanted to say, you know, doing the research, it was really interesting because I came across a lot of images, right? And most of the images, I mean, it's, you know, from the time that we're talking about, it's pretty much all black people protesting and no white people. There, you know, in some of, like, you know, in the March on Washington, of course, and certain events, there were more white people, there were definitely white people involved, but there was one really powerful image that stuck out to me, and I don't remember from what event it was, but it was a line of black men marching with signs in front of super scary looking police with like billy clubs and stuff, like, you know, there were like 300 police officers, and there were like maybe 20 men, you know, marching past single file. And there was like this one white dude in the middle of all these black dudes with the same sign that all the black guys had. And it just hit me because I'm like, wow, okay. What was this person's motivation? It's just beautiful. Like, this person, you know, and he was looking right at the cops. Like, that to me is super impressive. And yeah, it's encouraging that it's a more, you know, diverse set of people protesting now.
Totally.
I agree.
Oh, Darren, look, we both agreed at the same time. Perfect.
Yeah, and we're agreeing with Matt, which very rarely happens. So progress is possible, people.
I do want to say, though, to Matt's point, I mean, you know, all credit to the people of the movement, you know, especially Darren, you and I being part of an LGBT world and growing up with it and processing it and having so many major milestones that are, you know, people from generations before us never got to experience. It is sometimes to me so inspiring to see the allies of these oppressed minorities come through, because it really is sometimes, unfortunately, the allies of these oppressed minorities that can make a bigger statement. You know, as Matt said, if you're in the 60s and you're seeing a line of Black people protesting in the civil rights movement and one white guy, maybe a white guy sitting at home reading that newspaper says, oh, maybe I need to be like paying attention to this. Maybe I'm wrong here, you know?
Well, certainly from a standpoint that just from my experience, and John, I think you'd agree with me here. That's really what happened in the gay community. It was a lot of our straight allies that helped people to sort of realize not only, you know, how normal, I'm using normal in quotes here, right, it's just right. This zeitgeisty term, how natural and normal and great homosexuals were and bisexuals were and yeah. transsexual, all different walks of life. It was really the allies that helped us out there, along with the people on the front lines fighting for our rights. So
for sure,
that's been a positive thing.
Yeah, I agree. As we wrap up this part of the episode, we did want to mention a few other people here. Bob Moses, who was 85 and led a drive to register Black voters in Mississippi in the 60s, was more skeptical. He said the person who killed George Floyd was maybe an aberration, but, quote, the system they were a part of, that protects them and is as American as apple pie. So waking up to that, it's not clear whether the country is capable of waking up to that to its full extent, end quote. Listen, everyone has a different kind of lens as they see this stuff. He also told the Times, quote, the system works to protect the people who are involved in all of this at different levels, not just the guy who pulls the trigger and puts the knee on the throat, end quote. And he has a point in and of himself there as well. I mean, that's kind of, I would say, a lot of the core of why people are protesting, because it's not one-off situations here. It is a systemic, ingrained racism that has been generationally passed down from, you know, the beginning of our country. When you look at the bigger picture of our country, we are an infant there. You know, look at Europe, which has had established community and established civilization since the beginning of time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and, you know, the United States is merely 200 and some years old. So, you know, when you think about the way society progresses, I guess is the right way to say that, you do have to kind of think about that, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Well said, John.
Oh, well, thank you. And Matt, kudos to you, by the way, for doing 18 hours more research here. We really appreciate the effort that you put into the show for us today. And Darren, why don't we get into some listener shout outs before we
start? Let's do it.
All right, so Phyllis in our Facebook group posted a picture of her brown sugar bourbon. Which
I saw this.
I loved it. I love me some brown sugar bourbon from Heritage Distilling Company. And she said, quote, after listening to several episodes, I just had to get a bottle. It's going down Friday at 5:01 p.m. I feel like she gets off at 5 on Friday and then
that's,
like 5:01.
That's clearly, yeah. That's clearly what that meant. Yeah.
Well, Phyllis, let it go down, but make sure it goes down responsibly. That's all I'm going
to
say.
So the one I wanted to highlight is actually from Instagram, and it's from this lovely woman, Brittany Bowers Hutchinson. And she actually wrote us a couple times. She's a fan. She loves the podcast. But I wanted to read a critique because I felt this was important, John, and I'm going to blame you and Matt for this. So I'm sending the same message to everyone, by the way. First, I wanted to reach out and say how much I love y'all. Second, I'm not 100% sure, but I wanted to say I kind of think y'all are a couple numbers off on episodes. Per the list of episodes I see on Martinis and Murder podcast, I see two number 157s and 158 episodes. Now, I've debated telling y'all because I love y'all, but but I'm slightly OCD and couldn't live with myself if I didn't tell you. Girl, I get you on this. Of course, we all know Matt is to blame if this is true and should be punished. It could just be because the twin episode is a two-parter and maybe that doesn't count. Anywho, I love y'all and have loved binging the show. Thanks for all you do. First off, Brittany, thank you for putting the time in that Matt clearly couldn't even muster himself up to do. He can only count up to how many hooves he has. So four. So we really appreciate you reaching out. And I love a girl with OCD because I have the same thing. And it would knock me to no end. And I would have to tell everyone. So thank you, Brittany, for letting us know. I had to read it.
I'm going to make two statements here. The first is, I think we need a little like quote photo for Instagram that says, I love a girl with OCD with your face on it, Darren, for next
week. Thank you.
You're welcome. The other thing is, this is partially my bad because... Yeah, this was brought up like, oh my God, like a couple months ago at this point. And I went in and I started correcting all of the correct episode numbers. And then I think, I don't know if it was like COVID that happened and it sort of came a back burner thing that I had to do. But just know, Brittany, that I am very well aware of it. And either Megan or myself will get on top of that. Matt, do you have any contributions?
Oh, no, I hope not.
Reindeers, cannot be held accountable for counting. That's my statement.
I mean, listen, there were nine.
Wow, and anyway. Thank you for making a statement that literally could not matter any less to me. I really appreciate that. Yes.
Well, as we wrap up, guys, we wanted to say thank you, too, because so many of you have been very supportive of last week's episode, our Black Lives Matter episode. We realize, you know, our conversation and our contribution to this community and to this topic. And we definitely feel responsible to say something, and we hope that you guys are aligned with us, and we're going to continue just shining light in ways that we haven't before in the show, and I'm really excited about that, Darren.
Amen. Couldn't have said it better myself. And Matt, thank you for the research on this again, and we will see you, we will hear us next week with more content from Martinis and Murder.
That's right. Bye.
From the people who brought you The Thing About Pam, a story of fraud, power, and pride, Motive for Murder, a new Dateline podcast. Subscribe now wherever you listen.